This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. It's 7:33. Students at South Charleston High School are building a satellite. It'll be launched into space by NASA on a Soyuz rocket sometime next year. The satellite will gather all kinds of data and beam it back to the school for 5 years. This is what it means to talk about STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And the students are pretty excited about it. This is Joe Oliver's computer science class. About a dozen students are seated in front of a large computer monitors along the perimeter of the classroom.
Now what are we going to do? We got to figure out how to put the commas in there. So what are we going to do?
Going over a lesson in computer programming.
Yeah, initialize the first part, which is our number. That's the number you enter, divided by 1,000. Why are we dividing by 1,000?
In the center of the classroom, there's a round table where Logan Shomo and Shelby Combs are staring at a laptop, looking at tracking applications for the satellite they're building.
Basically, this is wireless energy harvesting. So it's how we pick up radio transmissions, which we actually already have our radio, like our base, in the school in the engineering room. But this is for a portable
tracking, isn't it?
Yes.
We're trying to find more information on it. This specific article is telling us about applications that we're looking to use for the tracking, and we're trying to find the best way to execute these kind of files as well as the best way to track it.
We're reading up to make sure that we can do everything properly and in a short amount of time so that way we don't have to spend a ton of time debugging.
What is BCC?
These students are building a CubeSat. The name denotes nanosatellites, meaning it's very small satellite, as teacher Joe Oliver explains.
The cube is 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. And we're trying to put a weather station, a gamma ray recorder, so we can measure the sun rays. And then we're going to put a camera on there that will actually send it back to our school.
State education officials, legislators, policymakers all stress that students need to be studying STEM fields today to get tomorrow's jobs. These South Charleston High School students know what the term means and are delving into all of the STEM fields to design and build this small satellite.
There's no way that we're not getting that. Like, that's our everyday life is definitely part of the STEM program.
Jamie Stover is using the computer skills she developed when she was just a child.
My mom had like one of the old Gateway computers, and I'd just sit and mess with it and play paint and stuff on it. Like, that was my life. And she let me do whatever I wanted with it. She taught me how to install programs, and then from there, that's my life.
She's the project's student IT expert. It's her job to troubleshoot any glitches her classroom colleagues have with their computers. One of those colleagues is Tiffany Grigsby. She says she gets a kick out of problem solving.
Because it's a new adventure. Like, each time you do different things. Like, one thing doesn't work, then it's like, oh, well, let's go try this thing. And it's a learning process for me. Like, I like to think outside the box and what new things can I try this time? You know what I mean? And I just enjoy thinking and learning what to do next. What do we do now?
But it isn't just these students in Mr. Oliver's computer science classroom that are building and launching this satellite. Oliver explains that this is a school-wide effort.
We have, you know, the English department, they're doing press releases. We have our engineering department. They're helping us design the components to go inside the CubeSat. We have the science and physics department actually figuring out the trajectory of how this is going to launch and where we need to put it and everything. So, you know, potentially we have the whole school involved in this project. So it kind of falls into the STEM and the cross-curriculum activities that students can really, you know, grasp and have something actually hold a real-world working project and application to see how it all comes together and how it works in the real world.
Back to the satellite itself. About half the size of a shoebox, this CubeSat has four long antennae protruding from it. Its exterior will be covered in solar panels.
It's so that way it continues to have power, because we can't put a little battery on a satellite and send it up. It's got to have a continuous source of energy, and solar energy is the most reliable and safest, cheapest way to send it up and have it live for a long time.
Logan Shomo and Kenneth Radias explains that it's what's inside the CubeSat that's really important.
We have a device we're going to use to measure the gamma rays. We're going to be measuring solar wind speeds, and then we'll also have a camera that's going to be half inside and
So basically, there are like components that we have worked on for from this class, and then we're going to put it inside the satellite.
We're going to have to tinker around with the exact design because we have to make sure that everything fits, nothing moves around.
Very soon, the students will take their prototype, place it in a special bright orange container similar to a small styrofoam cooler, hitch it to a helium balloon, and send it up for a test drive. The students will be following it from inside vans.
We'll have multiple people in the vans. We'll have somebody who's watching the live feed to visually be able to tell where it's coming down. And then we'll also have the GPS tracker telling us its exact location of where it's going to be landing. And then plus we'll be able to do a little bit of calculation in there and see with wind speed and all that exactly where it'll fall.
South Charleston is the only school in West Virginia with an FCC amateur radio license, which is a requirement to transmit to and control near space and low Earth orbit satellites. Logan explains that sometime next spring, the school will work with NASA to launch it.
First, it has to go through NASA, and they have to measure our payload to make sure that it's not going to mess up the launch. But it'll be going on Soyuz rocket that'll be launching. And once it gets up there, they'll release it. And whenever it's released, it'll start to track for us, and it'll turn on.
And sending back its data for future STEM students at South Charleston High School to study. You can see pictures of the satellite and a video of the students describing their work on our website, wvpublic.org. The debate over natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania has turned small rural communities into battlegrounds where fracktivists clash with industry and neighbors with neighbors. Debates in fracking communities have mostly focused on issues like noise, traffic, groundwater pollution, and the chemicals used in the process. But a small group of residents in Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, is leaving that debate behind in an attempt to do something tangible for their community. As State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary reports, their efforts are focused on air quality.
2 years ago, Victoria Schweitzer had stopped speaking to her neighbors. Schweitzer was one of the residents of Dimmock, who claimed natural gas drilling had ruined their water supplies. The small village in Susquehanna County became synonymous with flaming taps and jugs of muddy brown drinking water. But the media blitz angered her neighbors, the Teals, who said it ignored the economic benefits of drilling. The reporters, the activists, and the industry haven't gone away. But things have started to change.
You can see the gray smoke. Steam,
Steam wouldn't leave that gray tail.
On a recent afternoon, Victoria Schweitzer and Ron Teal are standing together on the site of a compressor station on the Teal's property. They're watching vapor rise out of a thin stack on the compressor that's helping to pump natural gas through the Tennessee pipeline. Teal and Schweitzer disagreed about what happened to their water in the past. But now they're part of a new group that agrees it's time to curb air pollution.
It got very tense around here. I mean, you were on one side of the fence or the other. You didn't sit on the fence. If you did, you got knocked off one way or the other.
The first time that Ron came to the home for a meeting, he brought a loaf of bread that his wife had made, and I thought that was pretty significant.
Water contamination is still a divisive issue. Cabot is still barred from drilling new wells within a 9-square-mile section of Dimmock. Anti-drilling activists continue to deliver water to residents who say their wells are contaminated. Rebecca Roeder, who founded the new advocacy group, says air quality is a more unifying issue.
If my water well went bad, I could choose not to drink that water. I could buy bottled water. You can't do that with air. We all breathe the same air, so everybody is equally impacted.
Roeder's group, called Breathe Easy Susquehanna County, is targeting emissions released from various stages of natural gas development. They want the industry to voluntarily go above and beyond state and federal air quality regulations. So Roeder's been setting up meetings with industry representatives. Meanwhile, she's selective about who can join. The group is open only to Susquehanna County residents who can agree on a mission statement that zeroes in on air quality and calls for respectful dialogue. Roeder specifically doesn't want people who identify as activists.
We're not part of a movement. We are a citizen group, a grassroots advocacy group advocating for the health of our community. And I don't want to be lumped in with stereotypes that would jeopardize my credibility with my community, because when you say activist to somebody, you think of, like, you know, 50 ear piercings and anger. That's it. Lots of anger, anger, anger.
At one time, Rebecca Roeder and Victoria Schweitzer stood with members of that chorus. Schweitzer was in the second installment of Josh Fox's Gasland and sat next to activist Yoko Ono at the New York City premiere last spring. Now she says she's been getting hate mail, calling her a traitor.
I respect the work of people calling for a ban, but what good would it do for any one of us here to stand with a ban fracking sign next to this compressor station? It would be carried away in the wind.
I think that they're hurting us. I think that the position that they've taken is willfully naive.
Wendy Lynn Lee is a philosophy professor at Bloomsburg University in Columbia County and a staunch anti-drilling activist. To her, the fight to ban fracking is part of a global crisis over fossil fuels and climate change. It doesn't matter if it's going on in her backyard or not. Lee believes that sitting down with the industry is equal to admitting defeat.
I can't comprehend at all how it is that they buy into the incredibly manipulative greenwash rhetoric of the middle ground, or quote-unquote best practices, or this whole notion of responsible drilling. We have been at ground zero in the grassroots movement, putting up resistance to this industry for years.
Rebecca Roeder says a lot of activists parachute into places like Dimock and don't understand that living with gas drilling means being in frequent contact with the industry, if only to know what's going on. Late one night last winter, the compressor station down the road from Roeder's home had a valve failure, shooting gas into the air and making a sound like a jet engine. Standing in her pajamas, Roeder left a message for the community outreach coordinator at Williams, the company that maintains and builds the pipelines and compressors.
I was calling her to say, do you have a way to communicate to those of us who now have your compressor as our neighbor?
Since then, Roeder has kept in close contact with the staff at Williams. Roeder says if that earns her criticism, she can live with that. Meanwhile, the group has started getting endorsements from local lawmakers and prominent scientists. Rebecca Roeder and Victoria Schweitzer say their new work is helping them channel the anxiety they felt when the drilling began more than 5 years ago. Now they're working on what feels like achievable goals for their community, not a long-shot crusade. Schweitzer says clearing the air in Susquehanna County would be enough.
If something happens to reduce any of the pollution, that's a huge win for everybody. So we have to fight for something. I mean, we're not going to just roll over and let them have it all.
Katie Culinary, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
For more information about the environment, go to stateimpact.npr.org/Pennsylvania. This is West Virginia Morning at 7:46. A chance of isolated rain with cloudy skies today. It'll be mild with temperatures in the 40s and 50s. Mostly cloudy overnight with a chance of early evening rain or snow in the higher elevations. Overnight lows in the 30s and 40s. Partly sunny, continued mild tomorrow.
Support provided by Wells Home Furnishings with a 30,000 square foot Charleston showroom featuring American-made furniture. Details online at wellshome.com.
Most West Virginians and Marylanders aren't aware they share one of the most famously contested state borders in the country. If you're driving along U.S. Route 219 in Tucker County, West Virginia, near the Maryland line, you're bound to pass by the turnoff for the Fairfax Stone Historical Monument State Park, which lies at the origin of this controversy. The Garrett County, Maryland, Preston County, West Virginia boundary line was such a controversial issue that the dispute was taken all the way to the Supreme Court, which had to make the final decision on the border in 1910. In part one this morning, traveling 219's Dan Schultz reports.
Hey, I'm Don Teeter. We're camped here with the West Virginia Surveyors Historical Society at Blackwater Falls State Park Campground.
Don Teeter and the crew are only a 20-minute drive from the Fairfax Stone Historical Monument State Park, which sits just off U.S. Route 219 near the West Virginia-Maryland border. The Fairfax Stone is about the size of a refrigerator and has a plaque on it explaining that the stone marks the headspring of the Potomac River. So why is this important? Well, as it turns out, the monument probably doesn't mark the true headspring of the Potomac. Way back in the 1730s, the highest court in Britain, which ruled the American colonies at the time, ordered a survey crew to determine where the Potomac River began. This was done on account of Lord Fairfax, who had been granted all of the land between the Potomac and the Rappahannock Rivers, and was naturally eager to stake his claim. Dave Ingram, one of the historical surveyors, explains how the expedition unfolded.
What happened on the Potomac River side is that a survey crew went out, started down around Harper's Ferry, as best I can tell, and started going upstream, and every time they came to a major fork in the river, they decided, okay, are we going to go right or left? Which stream is stronger? That was their logic for going to the ultimate headspring of the Potomac. They kept on going and going and going and ultimately came out where the Fairfax Stone is recognized today.
So, in 1746, a stone was actually placed in this spot, officially marking the western extent of the Fairfax land grant. Unfortunately, this would set the stage for a future border dispute between Maryland and Virginia, and later West Virginia. The Fairfax Stone supposedly marked the headspring of the Potomac River, which in turn marked the southernmost point of Maryland's western border, which is known as the Deacon's Line. By the 1860s, Maryland had several boundary commissions formed to redetermine the Deacon's Line, which it claimed was not a valid boundary line, because it was neither a straight line nor had it ever been officially surveyed. The border dispute was not settled before the Civil War came along, and so the new state of West Virginia inherited the issue. Decades passed, and Maryland continued to dispute the Deacon's Line as the official boundary between Western Maryland and West Virginia.
So eventually, all the efforts to resolve it broke down, and that's when the early 1890s a lawsuit was filed. And, of course, it took almost 20 years for the lawsuit to finally work its way through, which is pretty typical of that kind of litigation.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of
the United States. So the lawsuit went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which arbitrates disputes between states.
Tomorrow, Dan Schultz has the rest of the story about the border dispute between West Virginia and Maryland. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Our producer is Ben Aduccio. Our director is Bob Powell. I'm Beth Voorhees.